From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We start with the debate over body-worn cameras by police officers this week. The Rochester Police Department has been using the cameras for more than a year now. That's more than 500 officers, generating nearly 500,000 pieces of video each year. Most of the videos are not needed and eventually deleted. Some, though, are vital.
And a new coalition is designed to make sure the cameras are used in a transparent, consistent way. Some in the coalition argue that police should not be allowed to consult their own videos before writing reports. Here's the debate that we had in studio. First, you're going to hear Iman Abid with the New York Civil Liberties Union, then Rochester Police Chief Michael Simonelli, along with the lieutenant who oversees the program.
As we're setting up and establishing due process for the officers themselves and giving them the opportunity to kind of, you know, get the specifics on certain things, and if there's video footage that's available to the officers, we want to make sure that video footage, of course, is also available to the civilian, so whoever is caught in that situation as well. But then we fall into, like, how is the video footage itself going to be made available to the civilian? And then we get into the whole FOIL thing and, you know, and making sure that...
When she says FOIL, it's Freedom of Information Law.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
But also making sure, so is that going to be just as available to the civilian as it is to the officer? And in lots of situations, it could not be.
But do you want it to simply not be reviewable by the officer?
Right now, no. I do not.
You don't think the officer should be able to review the video? Mm-hmm. Chief Simonelli, do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I do. And we've had this discussion for the year and a half. My personal view is, my professional assessment is, that we're trying to write accurate reports. So we, you know, the ability to review the video is one tool to help ensure an accurate report. You know, in terms of some of these other issues that have come up, if we make an arrest, the defense attorney is absolutely entitled to the video. And we have a process in place to ensure that happens. So if there's a complaint against an officer, in the process of adjudicating the complaint, it becomes available. If there's a civil litigation involving an event involving a police officer, it becomes available as part of the litigation. So this idea that it's not going to be available, you know, in most of those contexts, and it is available to FOIL. Now, each FOIL is going to have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. So my own personal view is, we are trying to be as accurate and thorough and comprehensive as possible, and that's why, you know, I personally believe that doing this, which frankly most of the departments around the country that are utilizing body cameras follow the same process.
They allow the officers to review the video.
Yes, not all of them, but most of them.
Okay.
But I do understand that, you know, there's a different perspective on this, and I think one of the things I hope is body camera use becomes more and more common around the country, that there really is a lack of any legitimate academic or comprehensive academic research on, you know, what impact does have viewing the video on memory, not only for officers, for witnesses, for suspects. So as more and more data is generated, we're hoping that we'll have an opportunity to see whether or not there is an adverse impact.
Okay. And Lieutenant, agree with that?
I agree with the Chief said. And I think you have to look at, the officers will use the cameras to make their life easier. For example, if an officer pulls over somebody suspected for drunk driving and he gives field sobriety tests, he now gives the field sobriety tests and does not worry about pulling out a pad and taking notes. He knows he has a camera on him that are recording all of the information he needs to properly determine whether there's probable cause to make that arrest or not. Now the officer makes the arrest, let's say, or doesn't make the arrest, but files a report. He then can look at the video and say, this is why I did or didn't make that arrest. So I think the officers are using it as a tool to make their life a little bit easier. I think if you equate using not being able to view the body-worn camera video before you write a report, it would be like if I showed up at your house and something got stolen from your yard. I took out my pen, I took out my pad, I took down your information, all the pertinent information we need to fill out a report, wrote a description of the item, and then was told, go write your report, but don't consult your pad. That's notes that we've taken, or we've asked specific questions to get on video to be able to effectively and accurately complete a report.
Okay.
Right. Let me jump in.
Yeah, go ahead, Chief.
Part of our training is that to use the body camera as a kind of a virtual note taker. So, to me, I took notes. I still carry a pad in my pocket here because that's how I was trained 40 years ago.
Old school.
Yeah,
Chief.
But as I go out and I observe the officers using the video, you can see they do narrate. They do use it in lieu of taking written notes. So, again, we're striving for accuracy here, and I think it promotes that.
Chief Chris follows up to say, the difference is when a suspect is deposed from memory and the facts don't match the video, that suspect is called a liar. If an officer is able to review the video first, then write his report, then his credibility is boosted. The scales are tilted in favor of law enforcement.
Well, I mean, I think that's a very broad overgeneralization. I mean, I can tell you, and the body camera video is typically going to be recording an encounter, you know, between a police officer and a civilian. It, unless there's some type of physical confrontation or, say, maybe a disorderly conduct or resisting arrest, the body cameras aren't generally recording, you know, the actual crime. So I can tell you that our investigators, when they interview suspects, if video is available, they very commonly will show the video at some points in the interrogation. Again, that it's not mandatory, but that's something that they do quite often to try to, you know, reconcile the suspect's version of events with the video, let's say whether it's a security video or a blue light camera video or some other video source. So I understand the concern. However, again, if you look at it, as Lieutenant Perkowski said, that it just is another way of taking notes or documenting the officer's actions. There really is nothing nefarious intended.
Okay, Iman, Mike, where do you disagree there?
We've gone back and forth on this one, and it's and there's no, if there were a perfect answer, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
But is this an agree to disagree point, or is there going to be more that happens with this coalition?
Well, then
that's really part of what the coalition will be working with the police on, and I'm saying working with the police on, is to see, based on what's actually happening, with eyes that are looking at it differently than, let's say, the police officers are looking at it, we will work on this subject over time. This and multiple other parts of the subject we work with them on.
Now let's turn to grocery stores. There's a lot of talk about so-called food deserts, which are described as communities without a grocery store. And now we're hearing about food swamps, which describe communities that have a lot of food available, but nothing healthy. No grocery stores, a lot of fast food, a lot of corner stores, etc.
Mitch Gruber is one of the newest members of Rochester City Council, and he's the head program officer for FoodLink. He joined us to describe his views on how to make good, healthy food available for everyone, no matter their income.
That's where this idea of a social purpose grocery comes in, but it's also where I come back to time and time again, thinking about the curbside market as a solution, not as a cute little program that runs and looks pretty, but as the solution to some of these problems. Because the curbside market right now, we go to about 100 sites per week, pretty much every public housing facility, every federally qualified health center, we are there at the same time, on the same day, every week, selling fresh, affordable produce conveniently, and also doubling people's SNAP dollars, which is key to all this, right? We're connecting federal incentive programs to double people's food stamp dollars to buy fresh food. One of the huge policy changes that I want to see happen, which is not something I can control in city council, but I'm actively fighting with the state on this, is to allow our curbside market, which is by far the biggest and best mobile market in this city, in this state, and I would say probably in the country too at this point, I wanted to be able to accept WIC benefits. That is a huge, huge opportunity. People talk all the time about SNAP and food stamps as the key public nutrition benefit. But WIC, which stands for Women, Infants, and Children, it's for pretty much any low-income mother, is a huge opportunity. And right now, it is so hard to be a store that accepts WIC benefits.
It's why?
Because SNAP and WIC are the two major federal feeding programs, right? Or public assistance programs. SNAP is criticized all the time. The last time I was on your show, we were talking about the soda in the shopping cart, right?
Yep.
SNAP is criticized because you can really buy anything with SNAP, anything that's food, and therefore any store can really be able to accept it. WIC is really, it's a very good federal nutrition program because it's specifically for the foods that young mothers need for them and their children. And so you have to have products in the store like formula, like baby food, like baby meats as well. All these different things that most corner stores just don't have. So the reality is for a store to be able to accept WIC, you almost always have to be a big box. So Wegmans, Tops, Price Right, Walmart, they all accept WIC. But those are the stores that really don't exist in most of our city. If our curbside market could accept WIC, we could be going to the very places where we know there's lots and lots of young mothers, different housing facilities, and certainly different classes at hospitals, like some of the young mothers and centering pregnancy classes. And we could help people utilize their WIC dollars with food right there on site. That is a creative, innovative solution that is so far outside the bounds of what the state thinks about or the federal government thinks about, because you've never had a mobile WIC vendor before. People are concerned about fraud.
Who controls making that change to WIC?
It's a federal program, but the states do have autonomy. So I'm currently working very closely with the state WIC department. I was appointed last year to the Governor's Council on Hunger and Food Policy. So I'm there on a biannual basis talking to them about how this is an absolute must if we want to increase WIC redemption rates. And, you know, those are the little solutions that I think can really make a big difference. And we just need the state to get a little bit of pressure. It won't even cost them much. It's about making sure that they have the right partners to trust in a pilot. If we could reframe this entire conversation, what we're talking about, whether it's with curbside market or whether it's with the social purpose groceries, or what Julia said initially about the public utility, it's about trying to take the profit out of food for a moment. And that doesn't have to be everywhere. Like, there's a lot of, look, what's going on there in Pittsburgh with the Trader Joe's and the Wegmans and the possible Whole Foods, it's great. Give people all the options in the world to buy what they want. And if they have the money to go do it, so be it. But we have a legitimate public health crisis on our hands in poor communities. And the solution is not going to come exclusively from for-profit companies. It's proven to not work time and time again. We've privatized the food system completely. And the result is a very, very unhealthy populace.
So let's close this week with the car. Will we ever get over it? Can you envision American cities with wide streets shared by cars, bicycles, pedestrians, buses, trolleys, horses, rickshaws, spaceships, probably not spaceships, but pretty much everything else? Howard Decker is a board member with the Community Design Center of Rochester. And here's the thing. There's this photograph of Rochester, 1922, and that's what it looked like. It was a big, wide street. There were cars on it, but there was everything else, too, and they were sharing the road. Now, you probably think, yeah, that's 100 years ago, but this is one of those things where Howard Decker argues going back in time might be the greatest sign of progress.
I would argue that the car is, in fact, well, if it's not king, it's king in Rochester. In many cities, it's at least prince. Or regent. But I don't know that that's going to be the truth forever. And I get a little nervous when I think about American cities, and specifically when I think about our city, continuing to put all of our transit eggs in the car basket. Because the way we can move around cities is changing. All of that's right there in front of us. Other cities are meeting these challenges, and we're going to get lapped if we're not careful.
Now, the city of Rochester administration would say we're not putting all of our eggs in the car basket, Howard.
They are, in fact, not saying that. In fact, the city of Rochester has adopted a policy called Complete Streets. And the Complete Streets policy says that when you walk down Main Street in our city or ride down it or move around it in a wheelchair or you're there and any way, you have as much right to use the street as the cars do. So a complete street is a street that everyone has access to in every way. And the movement that spawned Complete Streets really began in Europe. It began in Holland from a guy named Hans Mondermann. And it's called the shared space movement. And that's where they've done experiments that say if you take away all the stoplights and all the stop signs and all the curbs and all the parking signs and all regulations, what you find is that traffic accidents go down, things are safer.
Isn't that
traffic
wild,
speeds go down, and everybody has access to the urban fabric.
Now, hold on 1 second there, just because I want to mention what Howard is saying here draws us back to a photograph that Howard sent us before the hour began. It was taken in 1922 in Rochester near the area of Main and Clinton. And that is, if you've never seen the picture, we'll find a way to post it. It's fascinating because of how wide the street is. And in that one photograph, Howard, how many modes of transportation do you think you can count?
8 or 10.
8 or 10. It's 1922. Now, somebody would say, well, nobody had cars in 1922, Howard.
Well, actually, in Rochester in 1922, there were 40,000 cars. So, yeah, there were cars here in 1922.
And 10 years before that, how many cars were there?
4,000.
So, in just the previous decade, the amount of automobiles?
Tenfold.
Tenfold increase. And yet, there was still hugely wide transportation access ways with 8 or 10 modes of transportation all sharing it.
Yeah, and now remember that in the United States in 1915, we saw the peak presence in our cities of horses. There were 26 and a half million horses in our cities in 1915. So this picture is really interesting in the extent to which it really is a threshold, depiction of a threshold condition, where the car and motorized transportation is taking over from a whole bunch of other modes. But in that one photograph, there's a bike, there's pedestrians of every kind, there's horses, there's cars, there's streetcars, there's all kinds of different modes of transit sharing that space on Main Street. And now we know that we're talking about Main Street where we're talking about maybe making it a little narrower than it. Well, that's because we don't really have all the stuff to move ourselves around our city that we once had. And so we don't really need to devote all that space that we once devoted, because in the old days, in 1922, when that photograph was taken, the headways, the distance between streetcars on Main Street, was about 4 minutes. That's almost like a transit conveyor belt. And of course, there's nothing even remotely like that now. You could wait 45 minutes or an hour if you wanted to have transit on Main Street today. So we really need to be thoughtful about how things have changed and how we can proceed to make things better in the future.
And that's another addition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear, where's the music? You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Talk to you then.